We are about to embark on a conversation that I tentatively entitled Dynamic Judaism. And when I started doing research on the title that I almost just chose because I like the sound of it, I found out that it's actually the name of a book. The book is subtitled The Essential Writings of Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan. He was the founder of Reconstructionism. One of the editors of this book called Dynamic Judaism is Mel Skult, who also edited Kaplan's diaries. If you want to see how someone who becomes very prominent and a profound teacher and shaper of wide groups of people, Kaplan founded Reconstructionism, but he also founded the National Council of Young Israel, the Orthodox, one of the Orthodox synagogue movements. He also founded the entire idea of the Jewish Community Center movement, the JCC. He suggested that to be a successful synagogue, we needed to re-understand what it was meant to be, so he created the idea of a shul with a pool. And in fact, in Queens, New York, Forest Hills Jewish Center has a pool. Many shuls have pools. And suddenly the JCC movement, wherever it's succeeding, and that's not everywhere, clearly we are a place that is struggling to have our own, realizes that without the infusion of religiosity, of spirituality, it's hard to figure out what it's meant to be. Kaplan infused both the cultural message, the religious message, by coining a term, which is the name of another book, Judaism as a civilization. A civilization must be dynamic for it to continue. We are much more than our ritual rules, but we need them to have the structure that we call Judaism. We are much more than our music, but we need it to have a spiritual experience, which is part and parcel of that structure. Dynamism is a concept that we could probably discuss on its own terms, but dynamic Judaism is a deep question. What about Judaism is meant to be dynamic? Because in a modern world, in a postmodern world, especially in Berkeley, where evolution, anarchy, individualism, the sovereign self, those things are bandied about. That's what we talk about. What is it that pulls us together? What brings us together as a magnet, as a constant magnet? This ancient faith that we know as Judaism is certainly not what it once was. We have rabbis today who would not be understood, let alone recognized, by rabbis 200 years ago, let alone 2,000 years ago, and what of the prophets recognizing rabbinic Judaism, and what of Moses recognizing the prophets, recognizing the ancient rabbis, recognizing today's rabbis. And yet we have the word rabbi, we have the word Torah. There wasn't the word Judaism back then, but Judaism is based on the word Yehuda, who was a person. Judah. So he's our ancestor. Would he know us today? We speak different language. We look very different. We all sit together, men and women. We sit together, Jews and non-Jews. The ritual life that we have today is infused by this thing called spirituality, which was not a thing in the Torah. Spirituality was not a conversation. How to do the Jewish thing was it, or how to do the Torah's thing was a conversation of the Torah. And the presumption about the God who commanded it is one that is certainly a question mark for us today. For those of us who would say something like this, I am a religious Jew, I bet you probably out of this group, 2% would use that phrase comfortably, and even they would have to figure out how to explain what they meant. And they wouldn't agree. Those of us who say, I struggle with my spirituality, but I show up because community matters, that's probably, from this group, I would venture a guess, 75-80%. And in that group, what does community mean? What does struggle mean? What commitments do the struggle lead me to make? I keep Shabbat. What does that mean? By the way, the whole idea of enjoying Shabbat is a very late idea. Oneg Shabbat, which we use to describe food, actually originally was the definition of your Shabbat candles, because we didn't have electric lights. And Oneg Shabbat, the joy of Shabbat, meant I don't trip into things when it gets dark outside. That's why we lit candles. In fact, in Jewish museums all the world over, in some people's private collections, it's just magnificent. In Germany in particular, there were these 7-pointed candelabra, that would be hanging from the ceiling right above your table. You only lit it on Shabbat. And it's called Shabbos Licht. Your Shabbos candles. It's not two, though that becomes standard suddenly. So, dynamism. It's still Shabbat. We define it as joy and rest, spiritually refreshing, personally meaningful. Those terms don't exist in the original concept of Shabbat. we can read God's refreshment, whatever that means, into our personal experience, into our communal expression of Shabbat, and yet it could be said that we are foisting onto an ancient concept our own desires. Maybe deeper than whim, I would say deeper than whim, but certainly not a word that existed back in the day. So here we are. We're sitting together on a Sunday morning eating bagels, and we're sharing Torah, and we're learning together. And as we look at a page, it's very important to recognize that it is a lot easier to talk about these things than it is to find ourselves rooted in the text. So we're not limited and trapped by the text. But in front of you, it was important to me for us to be looking at Hebrew too. Because we can use a translation, but Rosenzweig, Franz Rosenzweig in Germany, said, reading in translation, specifically Torah, is like kissing through a veil. You could do it, but it's not as much fun. There's something intimate about seeing Torah. So as we begin our conversation looking at a page, looking at each other, I want to make sure that we understand that in a modern community, there's always going to be a struggle with an ancient text because there are preconceived notions in the texts. There's a language that for some of us is incredibly difficult. All of us is incredibly difficult. For some of us, it's inaccessible so far. No one comes in ready to have an answer. But if we don't look at where we came from, I don't think we're asking a real question. So I don't want to use the word authenticity over and over, because I do in many of the things that I say. But it's incredibly important to me that in our own sense of integrity, we have a conversation that is accurate, that is deep, that is textured, that is real. So dynamic Judaism sounds really cool. And it is. And it has a starting point. And that was a long time ago. So let's start there. There's a lot on the page. We're not going to get to all of it, but it's important that we see some of it. So on your page, there are pages. There are three different pages. There's a total of, six texts. We're not going to look at all of them deeply, but you can have all of them to go home with. Just out of, to let you know, I replaced the four-letter name of God, which we actually discussed yesterday on Shabbat, with the letter He, which in some communities is pronounced as Hashem. In my teaching, I'll be saying Adonai, but so that these pages are not different from ordinary pages according to Jewish law, none of them are called Shemot. None of them require burial. They are very special pages, regardless, because they quote incredibly special places and people. So I would treat them with dignity, but just so that you know, every time a name of God that would require burial appears, it's changed. Adonai becomes a hey with a slash, so you'll know it's called a chukchik in Hebrew. And Eloheinu, which is another one of those sacred words, has a hyphen between the Aleph and the Lamed, which renders the word different. We'll read it the same, but now you can see that it's different in the Hebrew. Here we go, Deuteronomy. We'll jump into the text and we'll say something about Deuteronomy. Can someone read text A and loudly? We'll be looking at the Hebrew a little bit, but I'm looking for the English. So can someone just read that first paragraph out loud? Martha, please.
You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your tribal heads, your elders, and your officials, all the men of Israel, your children, your wives, even the stranger within your camp, from wood chopper to water drawer, to enter into the covenant of the Lord your God, which the Lord your God is concluding with you this day with its sanctions, to the end that God may establish you this day as God's people and be your God, as God promised you and swore to your ancestors Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I make this covenant with sanctions, not with you alone, but both with those who are standing here with us this day before the Lord your God and with those who are not with us here this day.
Okay, thank you. Now before we delve into it, just a word about Deuteronomy. In the five books of the Torah, Deuteronomy is largely seen to be a standalone text. It retells a story in large part from Shemot, from Exodus, all the way through Numbers. It changes some very vital details. Scholars have suggested it was a much later part of the Torah to be included in the canon. It has in it, however, you should read the Jewish Study Bible, the introduction to Deuteronomy. It is a tremendous text. Adele Berlin and Mark Zvi Brettler are the editors and authors of the commentary. They suggest that if a modern reader, you don't have to be an intellectually, you know, qualified by credential thing to be one of these people. For someone who's curious today about where Judaism came from with its intellectual vigor, with its confusion, with its demand to be interpretive in every moment, Deuteronomy is the book to start with. If you want to understand how difficult it is to be part of a family, especially in a Jewish context, read Genesis. The stuff in between the stuff in between is also vital. But each book has its own sort of message. Deuteronomy is a sort of a modern message in a very ancient medium. This one is about commitment and covenant. There are a couple very, very peculiar things about it. If we had more time, I would ask us to divide into charutot, into groups of two or three, to look at it, to find the things that sparked your imagination, that demanded something of you. We will do that with one of the texts, but I'd like to suggest a few things about this one as a starting point. And you'll notice as the texts progress on the page, I took them out of order. Three of the biblical texts are Deuteronomy, one of them is from the book of Numbers, from Bamidbar. It's a case study, actually. So text 8 that we just read, who's involved in the covenant?
Everyone.
Everyone. But who's everyone?
Then and now.
Then and now. A covenant is made in time, but who's obligated by the covenant? People who are standing there right now. This is Nitzavim. This is the part that means you're standing here. But it's not just with you, as the end of this paragraph says. It's with everyone who will be born. Anyone an expert or a specialist on contract law? Not looking. Someone just passed the bar over here a month ago. Is it possible for someone to be obligated without being present in the agreement? Yeah? Okay. Is it fair? In the question of a theological relationship, a relationship with the divine that has mitzvot, commandments, I wasn't there. Mystically, I was there, but was I really there? Did I say, yes, sign me up? I want these obligations, both the ones that I'm happy to do and the ones that really push me out of my comfort zone. I want to wake up and daven every morning. No, I really don't. There are some mornings I really do, but I do it anyway. No, I don't want to always, whatever it is, deny myself the food that smells so good. I want to choose, well, what I want. And that's really frustrating. And I didn't actually myself in history stand before God and say, yes. Now, in my own life, I actually did. But the text tells me that revelation and covenant happened in a moment in time. What's the obligation that I was signed up for? That's the next question. So, I don't know if you know, there's a prayer to say when you hear a siren. Back in New York, actually here again, it's easy to get annoyed when you hear one pass by. Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, the father of the Jewish Renewal Movement, suggests when you hear a siren, don't get annoyed. Pray for the welfare of the people that are on that vehicle and the people they're going to help. So the words are El Na Rifa Na La. Please, God, heal them. Heal her, actually. We see in this text that we are obligated because we are descendants spiritually. Some of us chose to be Jewish. Some of us are aligned with Jewish families. Whatever it is, we are obligated by who we are today. We'll leave the question of whether or not that's fair, right, or legally binding. We'll leave that up in the air. What are we obligated to, according to the paragraph?
Said that we're obligated to the covenant with its sanction.
Good. So the covenant, okay, what's that? That's relationship. With its sanctions means that there are details that we are signed up for. It's not this idea that we're in relationship. It's, here's the stuff. See the fine print. That's the Torah. Whether or not Deuteronomy means it's only the text before you, that's a good question. We're going to get to that. So here we are. We are obligated at a future time based on the commitment our ancestors made, and we're obligated to details, not just to relationship. Judy. Very good. Yes, exactly. It's not a covenant that's handed to you. It's a doorway that you're being introduced to. If anyone saw Josh Kornbluth's monologues that he just completed this past Thursday night, he retold a parable by Franz Kafka of a moment where a person spends their entire life waiting by a doorway to be invited in. And in fact, if you were acquainted with it or not, it was a very emotional moment because this person waits their whole life and never enters. And finally, I'm going to give you the punchline, but it won't ruin the narrative. There's this guard saying, you could try to get past me, but there's a scarier guard who even frightens me next. So you might just, well, sit. And the person waits and waits and waits until they're dying, literally dying. And with their dying breath, they said, you know, I noticed no one else has been here. It's just been me waiting to go into this gate. Why? And the gatekeeper says, because this is only your gate. This was meant for you. And now I'm going to close the door. So using that sense of dread, urgency, and invitation. In fact, this text is not only dynamic, it's pregnant. So we're obligated to a covenant, but we are eternally invited, I guess, is another way of saying it. It's always right before us, because it's always ours. We are obligated to it, but what exactly are we obligated to? I would say to the details, but also to recognize that there are entry points to it. One other question about this text before we move on. Why are we obligated, according to the text? We could have a modern, you know, in-the-air conversation about it. Why does Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, why does it suggest here that we are obligated to it? If we look closely at the text, there are suggestions. We are all present. We are invited to enter into the covenant of the Lord your God, which the Lord your God is concluding with you today, with its sanctions, to the end that God may establish you this day as God's people and be your God. The goal of the mitzvot, even if they are set literally in stone at the time, the goal of the mitzvot is not to get lost in the mitzvot. The goal of the mitzvot is to have a relationship with God. Chosenness is something we could spend a lifetime talking about. A regular chat on one foot, I would just suggest that, well, I'll just confess, the way that I see the word chosenness is that we are chosen to be who we are, just as someone else is chosen to be who they are. There's a unique destiny. But who doesn't have one? So chosenness is certainly not better. It's not hierarchical. We are chosen to be who we are. And if you're part of a Jewish community by choice or by birth, you're chosen to be right where you are. The latest Pew study, I don't know if anyone knows the Pew Foundation, it's an incredible think tank that does research on religious communities, faith communities. It came out last year with a realization that over the course of anyone's life today, who was asked the question, 25% of people who affiliate with a faith community have affiliated by choice with a new faith community. So there's a lot of permeability here. Chosenness is totally up in the air. What am I chosen to be, and do I have a voice in that choice? That's a different aspect of the dynamism. Rob?
Two questions.
Sure.
One is, how often does this happen? Apparently, according to the text, God is saying, I made this covenant for ancestors, and now I'm doing it again. I'm reaffirming, blah, blah, blah.
Good.
You know, what are we getting married again?
Yeah.
And the other question is, why does he say, why does God say, Rabbi Techa, instead of Rabbi Techa?
Oh. To the second one, I'm not sure what I would say, meaning that the ancestors are set in the singular. You individual, your ancestors. It perhaps could be a line, now I'm doing drash a little bit, it's not the text's answer, is that people have a different relationship with God generation by generation, which is why Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are listed individually. So I would suggest that there is something about the individual within the group. That probably warrants more thought. We'll give it another time. Your first question, how many times does this happen? How many times does covenant happen? It happens a lot, in fact, partially because it's not fulfilled in the lifetimes of any of the characters we're speaking with. Moshe doesn't see it fulfilled. We want to talk about drastic realization of relationship based on commitment not being realized. Said in a very modern term, I'm buying in, you know, I'm part of this community, where's my soul? Where's the fulfillment of that commitment? There's a lot of angst in this. I would suggest, by the way, and it's not, I don't think it's foisting, I think it's an acknowledgement that God is feeling it too. Whatever that means. That the God depicted in the Torah, and then certainly brought into, not into, to say fleshed out, that's totally wrong, but explored and perhaps discovered by rabbinic thinking, Hasidic thinking, modern thinking, philosophy, that God has a relationship and needs it. That God needs a relationship presumes that God needs. That God needs presumes that we are important. So to be partners in covenant means not only do we feel unfulfilled when the covenant's promises don't happen, it's that the relationship isn't whole, isn't culminated yet for God either. I don't know what to do with that, in fact, except to be present and to try to live up to my part of the relationship. So that's a modern response, but I think your question is quite right. Within the text, the unfulfilled covenant is something we rarely talk about. Moses, however, says, what's up? It's my turn. Why me, and why is it not done yet? Let me in. I've done everything I can. So it's very alive in the text, too. Judy, you want to add?
I was just going to add basically what you said, especially if Moshe is speaking here. I'm looking at the last verse where he doesn't feel the fulfillment. He hasn't seen it fulfilled, obviously, in the life of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Mm-hmm. But you can feel his angst when he says, it isn't just for those of you here, but he's trying to put himself into future history.
Right. No, absolutely. I want to move forward. I know that there are other people who want to share, but the unfulfilled commitment will continue, I guess, until the next text. So moving backwards in text and forward in our own conversation, text B, and we're going to move a little bit more quickly through this one, though there's a lot in it, has a tremendous, tremendous amount to suggest vis-a-vis relationship with God through structured practice. So in the question of dynamic Judaism, again, to give us that header, what's most important to me, at least in this conversation, is that we are acknowledging that a dynamic Judaism isn't only about change. I spend a lot of my time, a lot of my rabbinate, a lot of my writing, a lot of my thinking about healthy change within Judaism. But I don't want to be rootless. It's very, very important, I think, for us to continue the conversation of dynamic Judaism, exploring what it meant so that we can understand what it could mean. I know I said that twice, but it's very important, at least for me, to emphasize this. So would someone read text B, just out loud for everyone, and we'll follow along. Use the Hebrew if you'd like, but we're going to be reading the English. Helen, please.
And now, Israel, give heed to the laws and rules that I'm instructing you to observe, so that you may live to enter and occupy the land that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, is giving to you. You shall not add anything to what I command you or take anything away from it, but keep the commandments of the Lord your God that I enjoin upon you. You saw with your own eyes that the Lord did in the matter of Baal Peor, that the Lord your God wiped out from among you every person who follows Baal Peor, while you, who held fast to the Lord your God, are all alive today. See, I have imparted to you laws and rules, as the Lord my God has commanded me, for you to abide in the land that you are about to enter and occupy. Observe them faithfully, for that will be proof of your wisdom and discernment to other people, who on hearing of all these laws will say, surely that great nation is a wise and discerning people. For what great nation is there that has a God so close at hand as is the Lord our God whenever we call upon our God? Or what great nation has laws and rules as perfect as all this Torah teaching that I set before you this day?
Okay, thank you. There's a lot in this one too. Let me point out a little bit. Re'eh means to see. There are two times we are told, you saw this, you see this. And the very introduction to the text in the Hebrew says, V'ata Yisrael Shema. And now, O Israel, hear. This says, give heed. I use the JPS translation. But it's listen in the most deep of ways. Remember, this is also sensory. It's hearing and it's seeing. This is witness in a synesthesia, sort of really combining the senses. There's a lot in here to point to. Does anyone have an initial spark that they want to share? Milt.
The thing that struck me as it was being read, it says that Moses said that the Lord, my God.
Good.
Why didn't he say our God?
Very good.
Or your God?
Very, very good. By the way, you notice I only put one verse marker in this paragraph. It's where verse 5 begins. It's the middle of the text, right before that transition. Because the tone shifts. If I had more space, I would have made it a separate paragraph so we'd see it graphically. But something changes in the way that Moses is speaking. It was, you know, the Lord... by the way, Avotechem Ram is there now. Now it's the plural. Right? It's of your of your ancestors. And then it's the Lord my God told me to tell you. Suddenly Moses is much more present in the second half than Moses was in the first half. The best I can say is that he's more self-aware. He's desperate, in fact. Deuteronomy, besides being everything else it is also a last will and testament. It's a deathbed wish from a passionate, desperate, self-marginalized leader. Remember, he grew up in the palace. He didn't grow up the way the other Israelite kids were. He had his mom, but as a surrogate. And then he emerged as an adult. We don't know anything about his childhood. He's always outside. And then he's outside of the land. He's outside of the people. They run away from him because his face emits light from the encounter with God. And he's away from God because he's not God. And he's away from Egypt. He's away from Yitro and Midian. He's away from everything he knew. And he can't go to what he's been told is the most home thing he'll ever have. Right? So he's very, very present. And I know that that's a way that a modern person looks at a character, but he's very present in that second half. He sees himself in the formula. And he's totally disappointed, I would imagine, in where things have gone. Harold Kushner has a tremendous book. I think it's called Living with Life's Disappointments. And it's a vignette on Moses' life and leadership. And it focuses on that kind of idea. Jerry.
The line, you shall not add anything to what I command you. Or take anything away from it, but keep the commandments of the Lord.
Yeah.
Don't we interpret all of that and it's not really taking away and adding and so forth? What's that?
Yeah, for those who didn't hear Jerry, the fourth line in the English suggests with you shall not. It's you shall not add anything to what I command you or take anything away from it. The halachic, the Jewish legal concept, is called bal tosif. You can't add a mitzvah. That's interesting. Because we don't really have any description of the laws of marriage in the Torah. We don't have description of the laws of commerce in the Torah. We don't have enough about how to do a divorce, how to figure out Shabbat. So the rabbis have a hard time with it, saying, wait, what do I do with this? We're here to figure out legislation. We do legislate from the bench. That's Jewish law. Not to get political about it, but I remember that when the Supreme Court in Massachusetts asserted that gay marriage was constitutional and that restricting it was unconstitutional, the phrase that President Bush used at that time was that there were activist judges. That is not an insult in Jewish law, though. You can't not be. There is supposed to be some distance from the case so that you can be faithful to tradition, but you do have what your eyes see. The Gemara says, all I have is what my eyes see before me, describing a judge. And so, Jerry, your question is apt. Yeah, we do add, but we don't add. We interpret, we expand, but we don't add. The Gemara, so it's around the year 600 CE, struggles with this as well, and points to a few things that would qualify as adding. We don't add a fourth blessing to the threefold blessing of the priests. And we, in the Tefillin, we have four chambers. Tefillin, phylactery is my favorite word, but in case you wanted both, there they are. There are four chambers. We don't add a fifth. That would be bal tosif. That would be adding a rule. But clearly, in the question of dynamic Judaism again, I can't add to tradition. What a tension to be felt. Deuteronomy is aware that we might, and that we think we'll need to, and that we'll want to. Deuteronomy doesn't say replace traditions, but it does say don't add, don't subtract. So it's a modern tension actually being presumed here. Claire?
The only thing that I was surprised by, I didn't remember, was the reason you should do all this.
Good.
Is that other nations will respect you or do you or something.
Yeah, right. They'll respect you and say, hey, look at their rules. Right? So I think actually there's, you know, let's presume charitably. There is a kernel of truth in this, that a structured relationship that brings me so close to God is something that other ancient traditions didn't have. It's actually been suggested by scholars that the big difference between idol worship, which is the focus here, actually of Moses' exhortation, it's another, I like that word too, that idol worship is where you have the icon of your God, actually your God, very close, but access is not yours. Whereas for us, we don't have any physical closeness with God, and yet we have access. So that could be seen as a revolution, a cultural religious revolution, but that it's the rationale for the rules. It's quite interesting. Go and follow these mitzvot because they're going to think you're cool.
Yeah.
By the way, that also means they're going to think I, God, am cool. Mm-hmm. I am. It also doesn't suggest, by the way, that I am the only God. It means I'm cool. And I know I'm using colloquialism. It means I am sublime. I am the ultimate. By the way, just to point out, that's the second rationale in this paragraph. What's the first rationale for following the mitzvot before Moses pushes himself into the mix? Why do the mitzvot?
It's a quid pro quo.
Yeah, so bring it up more.
You owe this and you get this land that I promised you.
Right. You get this land that I promised you. There's actually a subtle, not so subtle, a very, very scary aspect of that too. Because if you don't, so if you do, you get the land. If you don't, what's going to happen to you? Baal Peor. Baal Peor, 24,000 Israelites, according to the Torah, died in a plague when they went astray, and that word is very important, to the idol worship of Baal Peor. So it's not just that you'll be, and I know the word cool is totally minimizing of this, it's not that you'll be admired only, it's you will die. Not only will you have this unfulfilled relationship of not entering the land, which Moses, I imagine, can't help but realize, even when he's not acknowledging it. It's that if you don't listen to me and you stray, by the way, that word is, again, very important. Theological monogamy is part of the message of the Torah, and especially Devarim. When I go astray from God, I am cheating on God. That's one of the reasons, actually, Uri Alter, a member of our shul, has suggested that God is described in those moments as Elkanah, a jealous God. We can look for any other word, but it's pretty primitive. Don't cheat on me, says God. I need you. It's a vulnerability within a theological relationship that much of Jewish tradition would seek to deny, apologize for, figure out a way out of. Maimonides would say, don't anthropomorphize God. You just need those language, you need those words so that you, human being, can have an entry point. But don't think it's real about God. So it's interesting, that means that the Torah means what we believe it's supposed to mean. It's according to Moshe Halbertal, who has a book called People of the Book, says that Maimonides was demanded of himself to have a charitable read. Since Maimonides believed in his philosophical conviction that the world was created out of nothing, ex nihilo, Maimonides demanded of himself that he read it in the Torah, even though the Torah actually does not suggest that the world came out of nothing. It suggests that there was a primordial, watery something. In the same way, Maimonides would suggest about our concept of God needing anything, that it's a complete corruption of God and of Torah. So you want dynamic. We invoke the very voice that would deny our legitimacy in our effort to explain to ourselves who we believe we are meant to be in the world. Our legitimacy is born of our consideration of whether or not we're legitimate in concert and struggle with an ancient tradition. There's so many ways to say that. Basically, it means we show up to be Jewish. And we know some people in our history would say, no, what are you doing? What are you doing? You, Rabbi, you do trim your beard. You, Rabbi, you female colleagues, come on. The answer is, yeah. Yeah, I do. And that is the Judaism we are meant to live. So, we have rationales for the law. We have explication of the law. We have threat if we don't follow the law. We have a certain stepping in of Moses as the arbiter of law. He's not a prophet who just is the mouthpiece of God. He can't help but be standing in the breach, speaking his own mind within this. Do it, guys. I'm dying, and I don't know that you're going to make it. I'm dealing with my own inability to make it. You want to read, by the way, the most heart-wrenching midrash. It's in a book called Sefer Agadah, the Book of Legends. It's called The Death of Moses, where he just doesn't want to die. He begs and begs and begs and succeeds until God says, even I can't change what I said. Dynamism has its limits because death happens in order for the world to be, says God in the Midrash. So in our consideration of Jewish ritual, it's important for us to understand this is about life cycles, this is about spirituality, this is about meaning, this is about my life. It's also about the choices that either I make or believe that are not mine to make if I want to live my life with meaning. Some of us struggle every morning to get out of bed so that we can get out of bed. Some of us struggle every morning to get out of bed to go exercise. Both of those are commitments we have no choice but to make if we are to live healthily. I myself struggle with the second one all the time. But if I don't, what am I saying my life is? It's sedentary, and that's not alive. Dynamism is both a personal statement, it's also a command, and it's a people's command. So we're going to move forward in the text just a little bit. I want to see if there are lingering questions from people who have not yet asked anything yet, because I know I'm moving fast and we are jumping around a little bit. Okay. You saying it to me?
Just thank you for making me feel guilty about having a new wife.
We're brothers in many ways, Matt. Judith.
I'm just thinking about Milt brought up the going from your God to my God.
Good.
And then he goes to our God. Good. And it's as if the, when he becomes connected to the you, it becomes all of us. And yet it's not that at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, if you didn't hear Judith, there is a transition from your God to my God, then to our God. By the way, in Shabbat davening, we don't see this in our Siddur because our Siddur corrected the grammar, and I wish it hadn't. Friday night, we use the word to describe the experience of Shabbat and for whom it is designed. Friday night we say Va, and we celebrate with her. And Shabbat morning, traditional Siddurim, which are not grammatically correct but have a lot of great meaning in this area, say Vo, we celebrate with him. And then Shabbat afternoon it says Vayanuchu Vam, and you will rest in them. And so the balance of gender and the sort of evolving of the relationship into wholeness is actually a message that has a lot of history. And I would suggest that Moses can't help but recognize he's not alone, even when he's feeling very alone. It's another important tension in the text. Thank you for pointing it out. Let's move forward just a little bit. We're not going to read the whole text of Text C. I'm just going to give a snippet so you have it in front of you. This is actually a very famous story. There's a man named Slofchad who, first of all, his name is just so cool. Please don't name your children Slofchad, but it's a very, very cool name.
You have a granddaughter, Noah.
Noah, right. His children have incredibly cool names that are user-friendly. Slofchad, I mean, Menachem is hard enough. Slofchad would be a real, real challenge. If you do it, we'll talk. and I'll just nod my head and say, Mazel Tov. Slofchad is a guy who dies. He doesn't have any sons, but he does have daughters. There is no rule of inheritance. Sorry, let me start that again. The rules of inheritance are delineated before his death to include boys. There is no legislation in the Torah to describe what happens if you have property and you only have girls. Quote, only have girls. I've got two, it's not only. And so the daughters of Slofchad say, this is not just. What about us? Our father's name and inheritance, they're going to disappear because we're girls? We're women? Sorry, we're women? And Moses has no idea what to do. So right in the middle of it, it's about 14 lines down, Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord said to Moshe, the plea of Slofchad's daughters is just. That's a great word. Yes. You should give them a hereditary holding among their father's kinsmen. Transfer their father's share to them. Further speak to the Israelite people as follows. So this is not only case law where I'm giving you an answer based on this situation. This is now precedent. It's a precedent that happens, of course, by the way, when? After Sinai. So the moment of revelation that we point to as the beginning of law in a Jewish sense, in an Israelite sense, that moment is in the past. What's now? Well, we don't have an answer yet. But there could be one. So they go before Moses, who's there to adjudicate, has responses. He's been set up by his father-in-law to be, ultimately, the Supreme Court of the Israelite people. There's delegation involved. Really good and rare skill among Jewish professionals. That was my verse 5. I just shifted. Now I'm going to shift back. The power of Moses' legislative ability is almost limitless, but we just hit the almost. So he goes to God, and God says, yes, their question is just. Here is the answer. So further, speak to the Israelite people as follows. If a man dies without leaving a son, you shall transfer his property to his daughter. If he has no daughter, you shall assign his property to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you shall assign his property to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, you shall assign his property to his nearest relative in his own clan, and he shall inherit it. Right, here's a new law. This is the important line. This shall be the law of procedure for the Israelites in accordance with the Lord's command to Moshe. The Hebrew for that is very important. Dehaita livnei Yisrael lechukat mishpat asher tziva Adonai et Moshe. And it shall be, if we're translating this more closely to the text, and it shall be for Bnei Yisrael, for the Israelites, lechukat mishpat, for an unquestionable just law. Kasher tziva Adonai et Moshe. According to that which God commanded Moshe. So the authority is intact. The law has shifted. And it's not limited to the case that was asked. We have both a precedent for the specific law and a precedent for a methodology. By the way, there was one Hebrew line that I'm really missed pointing out, and it is related here. Remember when you can look at it if you want. It's verse 4 of text B, and it's related to this one. You saw with your own eyes what happened at Baal Peor when people didn't listen. There was a massacre. And here's what will happen to you if you listen. And we say this verse every time we read Torah. V'atem hadvekim badonai Eloheichem chaim kuchem hayom. You who cleave to God are alive today. And that sounds either beautiful or ominous. You want to live really, cleave to God. So you could be alive without that. The other one is, the boat just capsized. Do you want to be alive? Here's what you're going to do. The life raft, the life preserver is right there. It's the only thing you can do to survive. Here are the mitzvot. Both of those could be true. Back within our text, what would happen if Moses legislated in a way that people couldn't follow? What's the consequence of law not changing?
It wouldn't last.
People couldn't follow it because Slovchad's daughters wouldn't be the only ones raising these questions. And justice is not only answered, cannot only be answered by what existed before.
Could you also say that this is an example of ongoing revelation, or the possibility of ongoing revelation?
Yes.
Because they brought something absolutely new.
Yes. Ongoing revelation initiated by human beings. One of the questions that we might have here is that the answer did not begin, however, with a human being. That's a challenge in the conversation. Matt?
What are the qualities of the answer? I mean,
without invoking God as the source of the law, said in modern terms, without invoking the moral authority of a religious leadership, revolution has a harder time sometimes. Of course, within our sphere, however, I want to make sure that I don't say that that's the right way to do it. The corrupting influence of religion in the political world shouldn't be left behind either. In this, there's no divide.
Well, this is very hopeful. I mean, you have to write down carefully. You can't
right.
say, "God says so, I say so." I'm going to tell you that it's okay.
Right.
So, it's very powerful, isn't it?
Indeed. But it's also very challenging because if you're the arbiter, if you are in the place of God as the verbal source of the response, even if you believe yourself to only be the verbalization of what a just answer could be in the world, that places an enormous burden. For instance, our board of directors of our shul just last week or 2 weeks ago unanimously approved that we were going to sign on to an amicus brief contesting the legality of Prop 8 having passed. And so we were one of many homes of faith and clergy separate from their houses of worship that signed on with statements of interest. So it didn't bind us financially or legally per se, but we were voicing our moral support for the contesting of this law that passed. Right? It represents, this amicus brief, 2 million people, 2 million residents of California. It's unbelievable. But the burden upon the board of directors, and separately upon me as a clergy member who speaks in the name of Judaism, strangely speaks as well, to be the arbiter of what would be a just law. Yes, it's redemptive, but it is also incredibly burdensome because we don't have an explicit revelation where God says, yes, this is just. So on the one hand, this is very hopeful. In the absence of a God who intervenes in explicit moments of revelation, witnessed and acknowledged by a widespread community, what is the moral power that a religious community today would have based on Deuteronomy's model? Because we have the text on the last page which says, don't add. The very Torah that empowers this kind of incredible revolution, especially in its time, says, don't do all that. Don't add. Don't subtract. And if you violate the law, you know what's going to happen. Because the same text tells you that it didn't work out well for them. And I, God, don't want you straying. So if you do the wrong thing, I'm going to get upset. And I'm going to feel disappointed. And my need will be exacerbated until the point that it's not you in the context of your people. You're going to know it's about you. There's an incredible tension here, because suggesting change from a religious perspective, again, in the absence of verbal communication from God, is not easy. Within non-orthodoxy today, in the Jewish community, a non-orthodox community, it's almost taken for granted that we have that kind of power. We know how powerful we are. We set religious policy as a community, in as much as some of that authority might be vested in a rabbi as a role. We have power to change the tradition. But the hesitation to change it, we might feel as our shul, more concerned about our traditions than we are about the laws. We might be more concerned about the melody that we use for announcing the new moon than we feel about turning on the microphone Shabbat morning. The tension should be there in both moments. We would just as readily acknowledge that gay marriage is a religious imperative, because that is our spiritual conviction. We would not feel the same motivation from our guts as a community about the kashrut of wine. Those two aspects are both based in tradition, and both ultimately tied up in how we view our relationship with law. We can use a different word than law, but it's law. Halakha is the term for Jewish law. It means process, and we as a shul are very good at process. But law means I don't really have a choice in this moment. Our communal standards are based on our roots as much as they're based on our power. I wouldn't advocate our power. But the dynamism involved in feeling that tension in any moment of individual negotiation of Judaism or as a community negotiating what Judaism is to be for our community, or reaching out beyond our boundary and saying, speaking in the name of Judaism, Prop 8 is immoral. Those things are so muscular and so dangerous. We are powerful, but it's very dangerous. I want to move forward with one more text before we open it even more. Sorry, Yonah, 1 second, I need to move forward. On text D, which is, again, on page 2, this is the opening that the rabbis found in response to some of the tension we've been discussing. Can someone just read that English paragraph pretty loudly, please? Go ahead, Michael, thank you.
The case is too bad for the city to decide. Be it controversy over homicide, civil law, or assault, matters of dispute in your court. You shall promptly appear for the place that the Lord your God will have chosen, and appear before the Levitical priest or the magistrate in charge at the time to present your problem. When they have announced to you the verdict in the case, you shall carry out the verdict that is announced to you from that place that the Lord chose, observing scrupulously all their instructions to you. You shall act in accordance with the instructions given you and the ruling handed down to you. You must not deviate from the verdict that they announce to you, either to the right or to the left. Should a man act presumptuously and disregard the priest charged with serving there, the Lord your God, or the magistrate, that man shall die. Thus you will sweep out evil from Israel. All the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again.
In this text, we have all of the other texts. If you deviate from the rule of law, you die. Now, we do not adopt this kind of philosophy, both because we're not fundamentalists, and even if we were to take the text as a surface document meant to be lived the way it said, we would contest that law. And of course, by contesting the very law, we'd be exercising the right within that law. It mentions the priests, the Levites, and the magistrates. This is an expansion of the power of Torah to legislate, because there will come new questions. This is at odds, obviously, with Baal Tosif, with don't add. It could be interpret justly, but recognize that the consequence of your decision is incredibly stark. Do it right, it's God's will. Do it wrong, do we have anything directly from God in this paragraph? Right. It's not God's word, it's God's chosen place. That's one of the reasons that scholars believe that this was a later text, because it's connected somewhat to Jerusalem. But it means all we have is the context for decision making. We are charged with negotiating the world as it changes. And the authority that we have today is no less than God's at Baal Peor, according to the text. It's a devastating formula.
But in some ways, it's like this, it's almost a recognition that there is no absolute black or white, that there will be those nuances, there will be those gray zones, because otherwise, why could a case be too baffling to decide? And
Let me say yes today, that's how I would say it, but the suggestion that there's no black and white and no absolute, I don't think that's what the text is saying, actually. I think the text is saying something more like, we have black and white today, but tomorrow might present a new color that we don't know how to categorize. So there is absolute authority. Its originating point changes somewhat, or rather its vehicle for communication speaks. We don't have a moment in revelation, we have a context for ongoing revelation. Where the thing that is gray can be lumped into the category of yes or no. Now, in our expanded sense of community, and especially in the conservative movement, there is the concept of mara d'atra, which means there's an authority in a place which is not the same authority as another place. And there can be multiple answers to even the most crucial questions. But the context of decision-making is incredibly important. Because we as a shul, and any other shul, and I would imagine within church law, within the surah, within any different setting of religious law, new questions do come up. The question is, what's the consequence of not listening to the response that's decided? I'll just say, from my own theological standpoint, I do not believe in reward and punishment being part of what God is. You don't have to agree with anything I just said. In fact, the entire thing that we've been talking about, you can disagree from start to finish. But I wanted to put out there that the consequence of not following the law is not the rationale in my life for being very punctilious when it comes to Jewish law. It's not about threat. That is a biblical motif. If it were about threat, I would be a slave out of fear instead of a beloved out of love. Like the paragraph that we sing before Shabbat begins called Yedid Nefesh, you know, dear soul, between people and God, that in many ways is a summation at least of my personal conviction within Jewish law. The text does not lead to that flowery, but it does lead to a compelling relationship, and love does command. Sufi wisdom suggests that, so does Franz Rosenzweig, and so does the Shema. We lead into the Shema with the paragraph, Ahava Rabba, Ahavtanu. You loved us with boundless love, God. So what are we going to do in return? Ve'ahavta. So we're going to love you. It is relationship. It is compelling. It is based in love, because in the paragraph of Shema it says, speak this Torah and do it. When you're sitting, when you're standing, when you're sleeping, when you're walking, teach your children, they're committed to it. Their commitment to it will be based on their experience of love connected to it, probably. So I have a little bit more to do, but Joan and Yona, if you're still waiting, so Joan first.
In decisions that are made in the
God's revelation, or in the ongoing revelation. There are many decisions that have been made in God's name.
Right.
And many people who have done things that we have later thought to be wrong, how do you know that the decision made in God's name is a true decision? And or even someone with good wishes having misrepresented, failed to hear correctly.
Yeah.
Even without achieving evil.
Yeah. I think that the literature that's growing right now by the anti-religious philosophical community, that is, God is not great, and a more recent book called Infidel, where Richard Dawkins actually, Christopher Hitchens wrote the intro to it. Infidel is written by a woman who, because of her contesting Muslim women's subservience and her participation in a documentary, saw the partner in the documentary slaughtered, and on his chest written a letter to her, and her excommunication from her family, her excommunication from her country. She now is in the States. Ayash is her last name. Decisions in the name of God is already a bad phrase. Ongoing revelation is a different type of phrase. So I want to make sure that there's a distinction between the two. But fundamentalism is exactly the problem. It's when Erwin Kula says it like this in a chapter. The book is called Yearnings, Imagining the Sacred Messiness of Life. The chapter is called Humble Absolutes. And in it he says, when I believe that I have more God than you, I go and get a gun. That's the problem. It's when I think my sense of truth gives me the right to impose it. So we're a religious community. I am speaking in the name of our community by talking about halakha as a commanding system. Would we as a community ever judge someone who didn't subscribe to those specific norms? Never. If people show up on Shabbat and they read instead of daven, is that a sin? I don't use that word. I don't believe that way. I also don't believe that there's some ultimate punishment coming anyone's way when they lead their life based on their own convictions. So judgmentalism, part of fundamentalism, is I think where we all go wrong when we allow that to happen. It's self-righteousness as opposed to righteousness. And the question of justice, which we're told to adjudicate, I think is based, especially in today's world, on a post-biblical concept of God. We've got the same root, same language sometimes. I use a siddur sometimes as mantra instead of the translation. It's meant to bring me to a place, not limited by the words. I think the world right now is suffering from an outbreak of fundamentalism, not just Muslim. I think that religion does have roots of violence, judgmentalism, and incredible distrust and hatred of the other. Every religion has that. It's our obligation, however, to contest it. We need to, Yona, I'm sorry. I don't want to miss the chance to hear you.
All right. I want to go back to the stroke of this. And that one thing is that, I guess, midrash or something, but the reason that it might have come up is because it was about the guy that got the one death penalty in the desert for Shabbat violation. That's why the girls are alone. And I just want
to point
that.
Yes. Yona, responding to what I was saying about Slovchad, brought out the tradition that Slovchad actually died, leaving his daughters fatherless, raising the whole question of inheritance. Slovchad died according to Midrash, actually, because he was in the Mikoshesh Yitzim. He gathered wood, which you're not supposed to do on Shabbat, but in fact, that Mikoshesh Yitzim, the one who gathered the wood, is never named in the Torah. And so it's Midrash that tries to validate the question of Jewish law by assigning Slovchad guilt. In fact, the Torah doesn't have that as its literal meaning, so I'm not saying traditionally it's not true. I'm saying the Torah doesn't have that as a connection to make. So, we're going to move into one last text, and then we are done. The metaphor, trying to drink from a fire hose, has been used recently when I was trying to reflect on how much stuff we put out there at any one moment. I apologize for dousing everybody. But I think that this is a conversation that ultimately needs to happen. both because we have an obligation to be a self-reflective religious community. And I think individually it's nice to have a sense of connectivity to each other based on commitment, not only based on day-to-day choice. So these religious laws bring us into contact with each other and make us really confused, and that's not bad. One last text. This one is by Abraham Joshua Heschel. Alav HaShalom. His yahrzeit was 2 weeks ago. He walked arm in arm with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, Alabama. There's a tremendous amount on the web at jtsa.edu. They just put up a new website based on Heschel's civil rights activism. This is from a classic of his called God in Search of Man. And Judy already wrote it by suggesting what she said, but here we go. He talks about Sinai as an event. Then he says, and yet, mere attachment to events does not fully express the essence of Jewish living. Event is a formal category describing the fact of pure happening. It's a piece of history. However, to speak of a pure event, of an event in and by itself, is to speak of an artificial abstraction that exists nowhere except in the minds of some theologians. I am based on a moment that I didn't even see. I can connect that in my thoughts, but was I there? The moment of revelation must not be separated from the content or substance of revelation. Loyalty to the norms and thoughts conveyed in the event is as essential as the reality of the event, which means whether or not Sinai happened in history, it happens. The content is pervasive. I don't need it to be true. Sheldon, you said this a long time ago. I don't need it to be true as history. I need it to be true. Acceptance was not complete. Remember the incomplete covenant? The fulfillment has not occurred. The decisive moment is yet to come. The event must be fulfilled, not only believed in. It's a subtle critique of Christianity, actually. What was expected at Sinai comes about in a moment of a good deed. A commandment is a foresight. A deed is a fulfillment. The deed completes the event. Revelation is but a beginning. And that's the title of this chapter. Our deeds must continue. Our lives must complete it. We must, and there should have been, and yet, we must not idolize the moment or the event. The will of God is eternal, transcending all moments, all events, including acts of revelation. The significance of time depends on what is done in time in relation to God's will. That is a very powerful statement. Right? Meaning is determined by what we do together, not by what we receive from one moment in time. The moment at Sinai depends for its fulfillment upon the present moment, upon all moments. Had Israel been disloyal subsequent to Sinai, that great moment would have been deprived of all meaning. If Sinai happened in the forest, it didn't happen if no one was there. The tablets are broken whenever the golden calf is called into being. We believe that every hour is endowed with the power to lend meaning to or withhold meaning from all other hours. We'll spend a long time trying to process what he said. We're not going to spend that time now. I wanted to close by, first of all, thanking all of you for participating in a very important conversation, to Art for allowing it to happen. But in terms of what we can walk away with, if you're looking for the Alegel Achat, the one-foot takeaway, right, lives of commitment are the fulfillment of revelation, whatever that means. And our power to choose the course of our religious destiny is wrapped up in our sense of connectivity to where it came from. We are obligated to be both who we were and who we are, and embrace with that kind of a burden who we believe we must become. I think any faith community that is that self-critical and self-aware, no matter what the ultimate choice they make might be, is going to be healthier than one that projects its past onto the future. Because we are present. Moses was present starting at that paragraph. And it is hard. And it is sometimes unfulfilling. But the depth that we can reach when we stick with it, because there are sublime moments when we are ritualized. Every dinner table is not always, how's your day, honey? Great. Oh, so good to sit together. But when we make ourselves take that moment and not escape from it, There are moments once in a while where you are so grateful, where I am so grateful to be allowed to be present. So a little vignette and then we're done. The vignette is, it's a tradition to wear a small tallit under your clothing. Growing up, I was the only kid doing it. And it was very hard. I did it, I didn't do it, I did it, I didn't do it. And in high school, I said to my dad, I hate this thing, these tzitzit. Why do I have to wear them? Why do you wear them? And he said to me, I wear them because you wear them. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, when you were 4 years old, you went to a nursery school that says, get tzitzit. So, I'd never worn them before. And I took you with me, and we went to get tzitzit. And that's why I wear tzitzit now. Now, in the moment, I was still a teenager. But I did pause, and I did remember, because the connectivity to the ritual, which was until that moment meaningless, captured me. And I do struggle with it sometimes, and I do have a pair of tzitzit, trying to figure out what to do with it at home. It's a little bit smaller than mine. But the ritual is meant to be full of love. It's not only a commandment, but it begins that way. We'll talk some more. Thank you. Yeah. Oh my God.